From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, actor John Cusack. Cusack's co-starring in the new film America's Sweethearts, opposite Julia Roberts. Over the years, he's played a lovesick teenager in The Sure Thing, a tough but vulnerable con artist in The Grifters, and an obsessive used record store owner in High Fidelity. Also, Henry Sheehan reviews America's Sweethearts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. One protester was killed and dozens of others injured, along with many police and journalists, in Genoa, Italy today, at the start of the G8 summit. The demonstrator was reportedly shot to death by police as he was about to throw a fire extinguisher through a police car windshield. With tens of thousands of protesters marching nearby, President Bush and European leaders issued a joint statement saying the right policies are in place to avert a global recession, though the economy has slowed more than expected. NPR's Don Gagne is traveling with the president. He tells us the G8 leaders have held one working session so far.
A topic that came up today was the slowdown that the global economy is experiencing, and there's talk about what each of these countries can do to shore up their own economies and hopefully help fuel a global economic recovery. Now, also today announced the formation of a fund to pay for AIDS and HIV research around the world, particularly in Africa. It's a $1 billion fund. The goal was initially to have an even larger fund, but that's the size of it for starters. And then throughout the weekend, they'll be talking about issues like expanding world trade and eliminating trade barriers around the globe and trying to deal with third world debt.
NPR's Don Gagne. Congress has given its final approval to more than $6 billion in spending for the military and other programs. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from the Capitol.
Congress approved extra money for a military pay raise, plus extra funding for Pentagon fuel costs and health care. The bill also includes money to fight AIDS in Africa and money to process those tax rebate checks that lawmakers recently approved. President Bush asked for the money at the same time that he's preparing for a battle with Congress over spending. The president's tax cut leaves less money to spend, and the White House is struggling to convince lawmakers to restrain themselves. Congress kept this bill no larger than the president wanted, but lawmakers in both parties are not happy about it. Powerful Republican Congressman Tom DeLay of Texas failed to get money for flood relief in his home district. And as lawmakers concentrate on the coming fiscal year, Democrats are seeking to show that the president's tax cut went too far. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Treasury Department reports the nation's budget surplus is shrinking. The surplus in June was 43% smaller than the May carryover. The drop reflects the impact of a weakening economy. A group of Republican senators sent a letter to President Bush today reiterating their support for federal funding of stem cell research. Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter was one of 13 lawmakers to sign the letter. On Wall Street, stock prices were generally lower, the Dow Jones Industrial Average off 33 points, and the Nasdaq fell 17. You're listening to NPR News. Vice President Dick Cheney appeared at a Treasury Department facility in Kansas City today, celebrating the first mailing of checks in the administration's tax rebate program. Steve Bell of member station KCUR reports.
The Vice President and Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill spoke in front of a 5-foot-high wall of bundled refund checks. Cheney told the crowd that the rebate program will provide a necessary stimulus for the lagging economy.
The benefit of individual tax relief multiplied by millions will have a positive effect on the economy in greater capital formation, higher productivity, and more jobs. And because the President and Congress acted without delay, the current economic slowdown is far less likely to drag on.
Cheney says the government will be mailing 80 million refund checks a week, a total of 92 million checks over the next 3 months. For NPR News, I'm Steve Bell in Kansas City.
Efforts to pull dozens of cars from a derailed train out of a Baltimore tunnel have been delayed. Officials say two emergency workers were overcome by heat while inspecting the tunnel. Both were treated with oxygen at the scene. Officials had been planning to pull the cars out of the tunnel with a locomotive this afternoon. Palestinians say two missiles from an Israeli helicopter destroyed a house belonging to Yasser Arafat's Fatah party. The activist within the party's military wing was killed in the explosion in Hebron in the West Bank. The Israeli army refused immediate comment. Witnesses in the area did not report hearing or seeing helicopters over the building. Heavy gunfire broke out in a valley between a Palestinian village and an Israeli neighborhood after the explosion. There were no reports of injuries or damage. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, filling in for Terry Gross. John Cusack has been making movies since he was a teenager. His films include The Sure Thing, Say Anything, The Grifters, Being John Malkovich, and High Fidelity. Now he's starring in the new movie America's Sweethearts. It's a satire about mediocre Hollywood melodramas and the publicity junkets which studios organize to pitch their films to the press. America's Sweethearts also stars Julia Roberts, Billy Crystal, and Catherine Zeta-Jones. Later on today's show, we'll hear what our movie critic thinks of the film. Terry Gross talked with John Cusack last year after the release of High Fidelity, the film adaptation of Nick Hornby's best-selling novel. Cusack played Rob Gordon, the owner of a used record store who defines himself in terms of his favorite songs. He defines everyone else in terms of theirs. Here he is in the record store with a couple of fellow pop music obsessives who work for him. Rob is declaring his list of the top five albums with great first tracks. The guy mocking him is played by Jack Black.
Rob, it's your turn.
Okay, I feel kind of basic today. Top five side ones, track ones. Janie Jones, Clash, from The Clash.
Hey.
Let's Get It On, Marvin Gaye from Let's Get It On. Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit off of Nevermind.
Oh no, Rob, that's not obvious enough, not at all. How about Point of No Return on Point of No Return? Lewis, so you can get up...
Shut up. White Light, White Heat, Velvet Underground.
Okay, that would be on my list.
Though not on mine.
Massive Attack, No Protection, the song is Radiation Ruling the Nation.
Kind of a new record. Very nice, Rob. A sly declaration of new classic status slipped into a list of old safe ones. Very...
Excuse me, I was...
In a minute! Couldn't you be any more obvious than that, Rob? How about, The Beatles? How about Beethoven? Track one, side one of the Fifth Symphony. How can someone who has no interest in music own a record store?
John Cusack, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Do you know any people who are like the characters in the used record store in High Fidelity?
Oh, when I read, Nick's book, Nick Hornby's book, I immediately knew the equivalent in Chicago. I even knew all the geography. I knew where the record store was when I was growing up in suburban Chicago. I knew the record store in downtown Chicago when I was a little older and living there. I knew where Rob went when he was depressed. He went right to the Green Mill. You know, I knew where he spun records. I knew the clubs he went to. I knew the music scene there. And I think that's kind of the, you know, the genius of Nick's book is that it really could be anywhere. It could be in Seattle, Boston, Chicago. I mean, I don't know if it would play in Beijing, but any Western-style country everybody knows these people.
Did you know those stores from buying records there?
Oh, yeah, and you just know the whole culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just know that whole music culture.
In a way, you know, like if you are really into buying books or records, those stores are almost like museums where all the rare stuff is. And the guys who work there are the people who are the real experts.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, one of the things that's so great about the book, and hopefully we've captured in the film, is, you know, these people who are Rob, Dick, and Barry, the people who run the record store and who are so obsessed by and define their lives through music, they really see themselves as misplaced royalty, you know, as these great underappreciated experts and scholars who really know more about anything that's ever been recorded than the entire world. So there's really a great sense of fun about that because they're so full of themselves.
One of the things that I think really works in the movie is the way you've managed to preserve the main character's voice. I think one of the difficult transitions in making any novel into a book is how do you get that interior monologue in a movie? And the way you solved that problem in High Fidelity was to have the main character, Rob, actually give monologues and talk to the camera, just talk to us, the audience. You're one of the co-writers of the screenplay and one of the producers of the film. Was that a big discussion about whether there should be these monologues within the movie or not?
Yes. I sort of, when we first started adapting it, we played around with the idea and then we sort of put it to rest for a while and were working on the script. And then finally we couldn't really figure out a way to get all those interior monologues sufficiently into the film, because the parts of Rob that, you know, are a slacker and in denial and inert and, you know, lazy and all those fun things, that was easy. I mean, it was easy to play him as the fool, but I think what gives Nick's characters, and especially Rob, you know, a redemptive quality is their courage at sort of looking at all those hard, uncomfortable truths that we'd rather avoid. And it was very difficult to get those out. So I think the best thing we came up with was we should just have him kind of confess it to the audience and start a relationship with the audience as a confidant or, you know, something of that nature.
Can I ask you to do a few lines from one of the monologues or read a passage from the book that I know that you have with you that you adapted into one of the monologues?
Sure. I'll read you something that we sort of start the film with, which is the setting is that Rob's girlfriend Laura has just left him, and he is retreated into his usual sort of isolated world of music. And he's got his headphones on, and he's got some angry music blaring, and he just looks up in the camera and says the following. What came first, the music or the misery? Did I listen to music because I was miserable, or was I miserable because I listened to music? Do all these records turn you into a melancholy person? You know, people worry about kids playing with guns and teenagers watching violent videos. We're scared that some sort of culture of violence will take them over. But nobody worries about kids listening to thousands, literally thousands of songs about broken hearts, rejection, pain, misery, and lost. The unhappiest people I know, romantically speaking, are the ones who like pop music the most. And I don't know whether pop music has caused this unhappiness, but I do know that they've been listening to the sad songs longer than they've been living unhappy lives.
That's a great passage. So that was one that you and the other writers knew had to be in the movie.
Yeah, well, we wanted to sort of anchor sort of the heartbreak with the obsession with music right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of how we opened the film.
Now, is it hard to do a monologue into the camera? You're not talking to a person. You're not reacting to anything. What do you have to think about to make that work? Because it can be really stagey and not work. I think it really does work in the movie.
Yeah, we thought of Alfie, you know, with Michael Caine as one where it really worked. And then there were many, many instances where it didn't. But I think just choosing the right content is the most important thing. I mean, you certainly mm-hmm. can't have it be a casual aside. It either has to be very, very funny or very honest, but it can't move the plot forward or anything like that. And I think once you start doing it, it's actually very liberating.
How?
Well, it just seems to cut to the chase in some kind of fantastic way. And it's so direct that it's kind of startling to do.
I always wonder if like the soliloquies in Shakespeare's time were the equivalent of this. Just like talking to the audience.
We should be so lucky. <I know. laughs> But I've spoken to other actresses and actors about it who've done it. You know, I know mm-hmm. Nicole Kidman did the same thing in To Die For.
Right.
And she said, you know, she was very nervous to do it, but then once she started, you know, she didn't want to stop. And I sort of felt the same way once I really committed to it. It was part of one of my favorite parts of the process.
John Cusack speaking with Terry Gross. Cusack appears in the new film America's Sweethearts, which opens today. We'll hear more of their conversation in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to our interview with John Cusack. Terry Gross spoke with him last year after the release of the film High Fidelity.
Watching High Fidelity helped me, I think, figure out one of the things that really works for you as an actor. I always believe you have an inner life. Like, when you're on screen, I always believe that you're thinking interesting thoughts and that the world is registering on you and you're having, you know, like a dialogue with yourself about the meaning of it. And that dialogue is, I always imagine, kind of funny also. And there's a lot of actors who just don't quite have that. You don't imagine having them having an inner life.
They're probably more adjusted in some way.
Well, some of them you imagine are too busy looking in the mirror to spend time having an inner life.
Oh, yeah, they have that disease too, yeah.
Is that something that you think about when you're acting, or something that you think either exists or doesn't, that one projects?
I would imagine that would just be an aesthetic that someone either has or they don't. It would have to do with maybe their mind racing around a bit too fast for their own good, or maybe something more poetic. I don't know, but it's I don't quite know why that is. But some people just have a certain complexity to their personalities that comes through on film.
I think that is also key in Being John Malkovich, where you play the avant-garde puppeteer.
Yeah.
Real malcontent. And
it's been a season for malcontents for me.
Yes, right. Did that movie, did Being John Malkovich, where you played the avant-garde puppeteer, give you a chance to work through the pretentiousness of some bad avant-garde art that I'm sure you were exposed to?
Oh, yeah. I knew those guys, and I've known a lot of them over the years. But also, I mean, I sort of know that person, you know, without getting Bravo Channel about it all. I knew that person within myself, too. I mean, there's a part of every, actor or artist, I think, that takes himself incredibly seriously and thinks that his perceptions and feelings and intuitions are a great burden because of their depth. And so I sort of had a wonderful time playing that sort of pompous, arrogant character. It's a lot of fun to do that stuff.
What did you first think of the script when you read it?
Being John Malkovich?
Yeah.
I read it 5 years ago before it was even an idea to be made. It was just a writing sample from this brilliant writer named Charlie Kaufman. And I could conceive of a world where Charlie would write that script, but I couldn't conceive of a world where someone would finance that as a film.
Mm-hmm.
But just, you know, to be safe, I told my agents, I said, this is a film I want to do. If anyone else does this film and you lose track of it, you know, I'm off to another agency, because this is the most original piece of writing I think I've ever read. And I imagine that would have been what it would be like to read, you know, Python when it first came out, the Monty Python scripts or something, just a completely original comic voice. So when I found out that it was financed, and I said, well, if it's financed, that means John must be doing it. John Malkovich must be doing it. And I know John, so I called him up and he said, oh, yeah, you should do it. And so I jumped at the chance.
Did things play out differently on screen than you had imagined it from your reading of the script?
Not at all. The script was really, a brilliant document. And, I mean, Spike and Charlie worked on it a bit, but it was all there on the page. And it sort of cried out for the actors to really play it as a drama. I mean, it was very... It just had a completely unique tone. It was completely absurd and inventive, and it kept topping itself in ways you couldn't imagine. But it was emotionally very, very straightforward. So you just had this sense that, you know, you can never get caught winking at the camera, and you can't get caught enjoying the madness of the piece. It must be played with pure emotional sincerity. And if you do that, you know, we have a chance at doing something new, which doesn't really come up that often.
Did you need a chiropractor or an Alexander teacher after working in the set where the floor is like half the height of a regular floor?
Yeah, they actually had a chiropractor sort of on the set. So,
oh, really?
You know, at lunch you'd just hear these terrible popping and cracking sounds, and people would be lined up to be adjusted. But then I thought maybe that they had just made the 7.5 floor because I was a lot taller, and Spike and Charlie are short guys, and they could walk around down there. And so that was just sort of their revenge against... those of us over, 5'7".
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Cusack. Your sister Joan Cusack has a role in High Fidelity. You've worked with her in several of your films. Is it important to you, when possible, to have her in movies that you're making?
Yeah, it's important to me, and it seems to be important to the people that I'm making the movies with. If there's a role that Joni's right for, you know, when we start casting, they all just sort of look at me and go, okay, well, can you get your sister? Because everybody wants Joni because she's so fabulous. And I know I'm biased, but I think a lot of people share my opinion of her work. So the idea of getting her to come in and do a week or two on the film is it's kind of a no-brainer.
She's a few years older than you. How many was it?
Four? Let's see. Yeah.
So she started acting first in a children's theater in Chicago. How did you get started in it? Did your parents think, well, he's nine now, time to send him over there?
No, I think, you know, I'd seen Joan and my sister Anne perform with this theater in suburban Chicago. And, you know, it just seemed sort of like a magical place. And it seemed like those people up there were doing all these fun things. And they were getting a lot of attention. There was a whole audience full of people who were quietly watching them with sort of rapt attention. And so I said, that looks fun. I got to try that. And then I tried it. And I think it was just a great way to get people to pay attention to you.
You think that's how it starts?
I think so. Yeah.
You did your first movie when you were 16. The movie was Class. Tell us a little bit about what the plot was.
Well, let's see. That was the Rob Lowe, Andrew McCarthy vehicle back in around 1983. And
it was the whole Rob Lowe era.
It was the Rob Lowe era. Yes. We were all a part of that. And I believe it was two people who were in a prep school. And one of the roommates has an affair with the other one's mother, played by the glorious Jacqueline Bisset. So I was kind of in the right place at the right time. I was 16, and they were making films about teenagers, and they made two of them in Chicago. And since I had been in the theater and I sort of had my chops up, I guess I had an instinct for auditioning, and I got those roles, and that's what really started to give me a career.
So it was Class and 16 Candles?
Yes.
Did the kids that you played in the movies reflect your character at all, or the kids that you knew in high school, these just seem like movie people?
Let's see. I think, and certainly when I was in Class, I was, you know, I always thought, or I probably had the instinct that the first thing you do is sort of play yourself, and if you can get comfortable as yourself in front of the camera, then you can start to play different aspects of yourself and different characters. So I think when I was in Class, I played, you know, tried to play a version of myself, or maybe who I'd like to be, or who I thought, a part of me that I thought would be funny, or, you know, if I was in a prep school, what would I be like? You know, I think that's the thought process that goes through the 16-year-old actor's mind.
Tell us something about what you were like when you were in high school.
Well, I just couldn't wait to get out of high school, and, you know, I really hated it, if I remember correctly.
Why?
Oh, I don't know, probably for the same reasons that most everyone does, you know, feeling like you were just required to, you know, retain data rather than think, or, you know, all the cliques and, you know, sort of the social stuff seemed kind of disgusting. You know, that kind of thing.
I would imagine you were pretty highly regarded in high school because you were making movies.
Well, I really wasn't highly regarded in high school, and then when I started making movies, of course I was. Which was another valuable lesson.
Oh, an early introduction into hypocrisy.
Yes, yes. I mean, I didn't really get much play with the ladies. But then all of a sudden, when I did a few films, I was taking the jocks' girls.
Well, did you try to teach anybody a lesson?
No, not me. No, ma'am.
You told Premier Magazine that when you were young, you had this bizarre amount of focus that came from a competitive desire to prove yourself. You said, I'd walk into an audition with an attitude like, if I'm in this room, you damn sure are going to look at me. Tell me more about that attitude when you went into an audition.
Well, I just sort of, I don't know, I think auditioning is a totally different muscle than acting. And right now, if I had to audition for my parts, I would probably be doing community theater. It's just a totally different muscle. But what I figured out is that when you walk through that door, you know, no one's going to want to wait for you to warm up. They're not going to want to wait for you to sort of get loose and rev your engines up. You sort of have to come through that door already going 60. They don't want to wait for you to go from 0 to 60. So you really have to sort of make an impact and get to a performance level right away. You have to get someone's attention, and they're looking for sort of solutions and answers. So you have to come in and be an answer. So I really sort of would listen to whatever music would get me revved up and sort of defiant, and then just sort of try to channel my energy into focus.
What music would that have been?
Oh God, at the time, probably some Who song or something ridiculous like that.
Now, would you be relying on ego power to get that "I am here, all eyes are on me" sense, or would you use acting skills to do it?
Well, clearly not the acting skills. I don't think it's not really like an ego. Well, I guess it is an ego that you feel like you're better than someone. You feel like you're the best person for the part, but it's much more about like a focusing of your energies and a concentration so that you're very, very alive, and you're in a state of flow, but yet you're very precise with the text, and it's just you have to come in and give a very confident impression of yourself. So I just decided, well, that's just not going to happen. I'm going to have to sort of work my way up to that, get to that state, get to that place. And I think that's really what auditioning is all about. And a lot of people don't understand that. You really have to make it a mini performance.
John Cusack speaking with Terry Gross. He's co-starring in the new film America's Sweethearts, which opens today. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of today's show. I'm Peter Clowney, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, we continue our conversation with actor John Cusack, and Henry Sheehan reviews America's Sweethearts.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's return to Terry's interview with John Cusack, who co-stars in the new film America's Sweethearts.
One of your early breakthrough roles was The Sure Thing, in which you played a freshman in college who isn't getting the girls like he thinks he should. And then a friend in Los Angeles tells him that there's a gorgeous young woman in L.A. who's a sure thing, and so all your character has to do is get a ride to L.A. What impact did this film have on your career?
Well, that sort of gave me a career, really, because I'd been doing, I'd done two supporting roles in films, and then I was, I'd take my money from that, and I was flying out to Los Angeles and sleeping on my agent's couch and, you know, doing auditions, and Rob Reiner gave me my first break, and he gave me a lead in a film, and so, and the film did pretty well critically and commercially, and so I was kind of off to the races.
I want to play a short scene from the film, and this is
from The Sure Thing.
From The Sure Thing, yeah.
My God,
this
wow!
This is the scene. You're hitchhiking. Well, you have a ride to Los Angeles, a ride with a couple of strangers because you want
to. Am I required to listen to this?
Yes, you are.
All right.
So you've just gotten this ride to L.A., and as you get into the back seat, you realize that this woman, this young freshman who has been tutoring you, who you don't get along with, is the other passenger. So Tim Robbins is the driver in the car who's giving them a lift, and this scene starts with Tim Robbins and his girlfriend introducing everybody in the car.
Are you Gib?
Yeah.
Hi, welcome aboard. I'm Marianne Webster.
And I'm Gary Cooper, but not the Gary Cooper that's dead. Hop in.
Allison, this is Gib.
And Gib, this is Allison.
I knew I should have taken the bus.
What, and wind up sitting next to some sleazebag? Some sleazebag you don't know?
Oh, you two know each other.
We're old friends.
We're not old friends. We're acquaintances. Very distant acquaintances.
Kids, come on. Let's make this a fun trip, okay?
You guys know any show tunes?
That's a great idea. When the moon is in the seventh house.
And Jupiter aligns with Mars.
Well, then peace will guide the planets.
And love.
Up will steer the skies. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
Oh, John Cusack, I chose that scene because I think that's the first scene that you did with Tim Robbins, with whom you've become good friends. And
oh, yeah.
You're in his film, Cradle of Rock. He's in High Fidelity in a small but very funny role. So was this your first scene together?
Yeah, that's where I met Tim. That's where I met Tim. He was 26 and I was 16.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah. What was it about you that connected?
Well, I think he's... you know, he's a very deranged individual in a lot of ways. So we just got along great and very, very funny and smart. And so we just became fast friends.
Now, I know that you created a theater company, I think, in Chicago called New Crime Theater that I read was inspired by the one that that Tim Robbins had created. Is that true?
Yeah, well, Tim was in a theater company called The Actors Gang. And when we did The Sure Thing, we became friends and, you know, had similar interests in films and plays. And then I think what happened was we were in New York somewhere together, Tim and I, and I think Reagan had bombed Libya, and we found it such a depressing time, and such a depressing time. Well, all the Reagan administration seemed like a horribly depressing time, but that moment was, we felt was so horrible that we decided to go off and just, you know, do some piece of political theater about that, and I went out and worked with the Actors Gang and did a play with them, and was introduced to the Commedia dell'arte style. Actually, I'd been introduced to it earlier. I'd come out and we'd done a workshop with he was working with some people at UCLA and the Théâtre du Soleil in Paris, Georges Bigot, and I'd come out and done that with him, and then once Reagan bombed Libya, we decided to go do a play. And that was when I worked with the Actors Gang. And then later I took that style that I had learned and started a company in Chicago. And Tim came out and we did a play there. And so it was just sort of like, yeah, it was kind of like a brother-sister company kind of thing.
John Cusack talking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to our interview with John Cusack. Cusack co-stars in the film America's Sweethearts, which opens today.
Let me get to your movie, Say Anything, which is, I think, another early role that really helped establish you. And in this, you play someone in high school who falls in love with the class valedictorian, but you have no academic gifts, and she's like the really smart one. So this seems to a lot of people like an incredible mismatch. You're also kind of directionless outside of your love for kickboxing. So in this scene, you're at a dinner at your girlfriend's father's house, and all the adults at the table are asking you questions to figure out whether you're a worthy boyfriend.
So, Lloyd, you graduated Lakewood, right?
Yes, sir.
What are you going to do now?
Yeah, Lloyd. What are your plans for the future? Spend as much time possible with Diane before she leaves?
Seriously, Lloyd.
I'm totally and completely serious.
No, really.
You mean like career? I don't know. I've thought about this quite a bit, sir, and I would have to say, considering what's waiting out there for me, I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold, bought, or processed, or repair anything sold, bought, or processed. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that. So my father's in the Army. He wants me to join, but I can't work for that corporation. So what I've been doing lately is kickboxing, which is a new sport, but I think it's got a good future. As far as career longevity, I don't really know because, you know, you can't really tell. If you're 8-6 as a fighter, you know, it's no good. You know, you have to be great. But I can't really tell if I'm great until I've had a couple of pro fights. But I haven't been knocked down yet. I don't know. I can't figure it all out tonight, sir. I'm just going to hang with your daughter.
John Cusack in a scene from Say Anything. Those are very funny line readings in that. Did you do those lines many different ways before figuring out how you wanted to do it for the actual shoot?
No, not really. What I did was is we had... Cameron and I were working on that scene. And
this is Cameron Crowe, the director.
Cameron Crowe and I were working on that scene, and we sort of wrote that speech together because I felt like there was a lot more that we could say, and we really wanted to sort of give him a very sort of distinct worldview. And it was sort of a worldview that, I guess, matched my own when I was that age, so when I was 20, 21. It's sort of about fears of joining into a society that you don't quite really understand or have a lot of respect for in a lot of ways. So it wasn't really line readings as much as once we've sort of, Cameron and I were working and we just came out with that rap and then we just sort of said, all right, that's it, let's do it. And then we just tried it a couple different ways. We tried a few of them longer, a few of them shorter. But it's not really about line readings as much as it is just sort of getting into the right kind of state of flow, I think.
I think some people who get started in, you know, quote, youth films have a hard time getting out of it and having adult careers. Were you ever worried about that? Was that ever a problem?
I was never really worried about it because when I was playing teenagers and young people, I was a teenager and young person, so I always just sort of assumed, maybe naively, that when I got older, I'd play older roles. So I didn't have that worry. I mean, I you know, of course, when you're younger, you want to do more substantial stuff, and you always think that there's better roles waiting for you as you get older, but I didn't have that kind of concern.
Did you go to drama school?
No, I didn't.
How come?
I never did. Well, I always thought that, I mean, I was working already in films. I mean, I'd done 3 films and a lead in a film before I graduated high school. And I had a lot of training at the Piven Theater Workshop in, you know, Chicago and Evanston. So I'd been doing theater and working. And I always sort of thought that, you know, the people I'd met who had sort of gone to theater school and stuff, and they always seemed to be, they seemed to be sort of, there's something precious about them. This is just my own opinion. I'm not saying it's true, but there used to be something sort of precious about it all. And I always thought, well, if you're going to go to college, you should learn about everything else you don't know, because you can get a lot of experience acting by just doing it and working with great people. So when I went to NYU, I was studying liberal arts for a semester. I wasn't studying theater.
A whole semester, huh?
Yeah, made it all the way through.
You dropped out after that?
Yeah, I went. Well, I had sort of too much fire in the belly. Really, I wasn't ready to go to school because I was working and I was getting offers, and I really wanted to work.
John Cusack is my guest. Let me get to another film that I think showed a completely different side of you from your earlier films, and I'm thinking of The Grifters. After playing all these like lovable loser teenage roles, in The Grifters you played a guy in his mid-20s who is a con artist, and his mother, played by Angelica Houston, is a longtime con artist, and his girlfriend, played by Annette Bening, is a con artist too.
Yeah, Roy was doomed from the day he was born. That's what we used to say.
Yeah, and it's a terrific film, a kind of film noir, contemporary film noir. And you're really opaque in this movie. I mean, it's hard. You know, you watch this movie and you know your character is always thinking, but you're not necessarily sure what. And you're not quite a benign character in this either.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in your other movies, even if you're kind of a loser or you're thoughtless about something, you're not dangerous in the way that this character has the potential of being, although he seems to have this kind of decency beneath. But you're kind of braced for any kind of surprise, mm-hmm. because the character's so opaque. Let me play a scene from the movie. This is a scene with Annette Bening, who plays your girlfriend in the movie. And she has a scheme for this really ambitious con that she wants to team up with you on. And you've been taught the hard way that it's dangerous to have a partner if you're a con man. So you don't want to go along with the plan to be partners.
What's going on? Why don't you want to team up?
The best reason I can think of is that you scare the hell out of me. I have seen women like you before, baby. You're double tough, and you are sharp as a razor, and you get what you want or else. But you don't make it work forever. Sooner or later, the lightning hits, and I'm not going to be around when it hits you.
By God, it's your mother. It's Lily.
What?
Sure it is. That's why you act so funny around each other.
What's that?
Oh, don't act so goddamn innocent. You and your own mother? Ugh. You like to go back where you've been, huh?
Watch your mouth.
Yeah, I'm wise to you. I should have seen it before, you rotten son of a bitch. How is it, huh? How do you like it with... Stop.
That's not like me. I don't do this. That's why we wouldn't work together. You're disgusting. Your mind is so filthy, it's hard to look at you. Goodbye.
That's a great scene. John Cusack, what did The Grifters enable you to do that you hadn't done on film before?
Oh, I'd say kind of a level of sophistication. A drama that I'd never had an opportunity to do, not even close.
Stephen Frears, who also directed your new movie, High Fidelity, directed The Grifters. What did you have to do when you auditioned for this part to prove that you could play somebody as tough as this character is, and as both tough and vulnerable, but not the kind of like more kind of cute, lovable loser role that you'd been playing in the teen movies?
The cute, lovable loser role. Well, I think what happened was I'd read The Grifters, and I was a fan of Jim Thompson from high school. And when Stephen wanted to meet me, you know, I told him that I'd always wanted to do the book, and I'd actually tried to option the book, I remembered, when I was 19 or 20, because I thought it was so great. I thought it was this great combination of, you know, a pulp crime novel and Greek tragedy. I just thought it was so fantastic. And so I went to meet him, and I think he was at the Algonquin Hotel. And Stephen is a very strange and strange man, a wonderful man, and but very, very odd processes. And he met me in the Algonquin Hotel, and I sat down, and he just started circling me. He just started walking around me, looking at me, sort of rubbing his lip. And so what I did, I just looked back, and he turned around, and so then he went behind me, and I turned my chair around, followed him around, and we just sort of did this dance. And then we started talking about the film and talking about the script and the book, and then that was it. I never auditioned. He just hired me.
That's great. In one of the first scenes, you're doing a con in that scene. You're at a bar. You hold up a 20 to the bartender, and as you actually give him the bill, you're making eye contact with him so he can't see that you've replaced the 20 with a 10. I'm wondering where you learned the grifts from. Are these grifts from the book?
Yeah, many of the grifts were from the book, but we also brought in a lot of professional cheaters and and some experts on the subject, like Ricky Jay. He came on in, and we actually found a few mechanics, and mechanics are people who do that for a living, and they came in and they gave me little tutorials on lying and deception. It was kind of a great way to spend a September.
I imagine you learned a lot about acting from that, because that's what these guys have to do, is act.
Well, I learned a lot about how to play the character from those guys, because they were almost like, you know, you said opaque, and I mean, they were almost like invisible. You'd be in a room with them, and they'd be the most kind of personable guys, but they'd be guys who you'd leave the room, and you couldn't remember what they were wearing or what they really looked like, or there was nothing distinctive about them. They were just, they were kind of just non-persons, and I think it was it's by choice, because they don't want to be remembered or noticed, so that they were kind of fascinating characters.
But I'm wondering if even you learned about things like eye contact in ways you hadn't before, like using your eyes to divert somebody when you're doing a con on them, or to hold their attention so they don't see the slip of the hand. You know, they don't see what your hands are doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think mostly you find out that it's, I mean, you find out about all those diversions, and you find out about that there's a real power in not asserting any aggressive energy. So there's, you do sort of learn about the great power of restraint. But more than anything else, you find out that the grifts are just about having information that the other person doesn't have. In many various forms. You just have some information that he doesn't have, and that makes him very, very gullible.
You said that when you were young, acting was about getting attention. This is when you were really young, like 9, 10. What's acting about to you now?
I just think it's about expression and trying to tell stories and find out how people are alike. You know, what it means to be kind of human and go through the same experiences. And I think it's just a very personal form of expression that's a strange one, because it's such a, you know, there's not a more expensive art form in history, and there's so much money and pressure about it. But ultimately it comes down to these very, very, very personal kind of performances on this large scale. So I'm sort of hooked.
John Cusack, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
John Cusack spoke last year with Terry Gross. He co-stars in the new film America's Sweethearts, which opens today. What does our film critic think of America's Sweethearts? A review coming up after this break. I'm Peter Clowney, and this is Fresh Air. America's Sweethearts is a new backstage comedy about Hollywood. It stars Billy Crystal, who also co-wrote the film, as a veteran press agent. Julia Roberts is a harried personal assistant to her movie star sister, played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. And John Cusack is the movie star's movie star husband. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
America's Sweethearts promises all sorts of send-ups of Hollywood egos and practices, but its most shocking revelation isn't a joke at all. It's that people in the movie business consider Larry King a tough interviewer. Yes, the king of the journalistic Big Wet Kiss, who naturally plays himself in this wet noodle of a farce, is portrayed as a dangerous, probing interrogator. Less an insider's satire of the movie business than a primer for psychiatrists specializing in self-delusion, America's Sweethearts focuses an occluded lens on the funhouse mirror world of Hollywood publicity. This distortion of a distortion does feature a handful of straightforward pleasures. Billy Crystal, who co-wrote the script and produced the film, has made sure that his character, publicist Lee Phillips, has a suitable ration of belly laugh-inducing one-liners. And Julia Roberts, who is now in the unexpected prime of a solid career, demonstrates that the last hurdle between her and greatness is her inability to pick a good script. But what's really interesting about this film is how it reveals the weird perspective of stars and apparently studio executives. The movie's directed by Joe Roth, now running his own hybrid operation after heading the Disney and Fox film studios. Roth isn't much of a director. His model seems to be the railroad station master who keeps trains running on time. But this isn't just a filmmaking blemish, it's an insight. For if Roth thinks he has done a fine job directing, that explains why so many mediocre directors have found Hollywood sinecures while legitimate talents have gone begging. Roth and his ilk think clumsy and quick is the way to go. The movie takes place at a Nevada hotel, part of a chain which gets plenty of free plugs, where Crystal Phillips is running a press junket. A junket is one of those notoriously cushy gatherings where the entertainment press is invited, often at a studio's expense, to spend a day or a weekend attending screenings and doing interviews for soon-to-be-released movies. In tune with the movie's moral obtuseness, a number of journalists have taken parts in the movie. How can they possibly pretend to maintain some sort of critical distance ever again from Billy Crystal, Julia Roberts, or Joe Roth and their future projects after having a high old time making a movie with them? Amidst all this corruption, Crystal and his writing partner, Peter Tolan, slap down a love story involving Roberts' character. She plays Kiki Harrison, the sister of and personal assistant to movie star Gwen Harrison, played with an astonishing lack of wit by Catherine Zeta-Jones. Phillips, the publicist, is trying to manufacture press interest in a movie by pretending that Gwen is reuniting with her longtime co-star and husband, Eddie Thomas, played by John Cusack. As much as Gwen is horribly egocentric, so Eddie is a pussycat. This naturally means he must be more suited to the doormat Kiki, though the dumb lug doesn't realize it yet. Here, Crystal Phillips and Roberts' Kiki discuss the vagaries of junket love.
What the hell happened?
Bad morning. Preceded by 33 bad years.
Does this have something to do with Gwen?
Of course not. I love my sister. I love everything about her. Kiki? Kikikins? Who's smoking? I smell smoke. Is someone smoking within a 6-mile radius of where I'm standing? Stop them, Kiki. Stop them. Oh, ma'am, the butter? What, are they out of butter? How can you run out of butter?
Well, I have one theory.
You know what? I need an assistant. Because if I had an assistant, she would be outside right now milking a cow, and I would never, ever run out of butter. Oh, Kiki, my butter has touched another food. I need new butter. Anything you want, honey. That's the way it goes, Lee. Right? You're a publicist. You know anything they want, right?
Sounds all right, doesn't it? Crystal and Roberts do seem to connect a bit. So cleverly, the filmmakers have ensured that this is one of the very few scenes in the movie the two share. For the most part, Crystal stars in a comedy vehicle, while Roberts leads a romance featuring the unpalatable Jones and the awkwardly miscast and at-sea Cusack. Yes, by all means, let's have some fun about the personal lives of Hollywood citizens. Anything to distract us from the dispiriting mediocrity of their professional output.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. We've learned that Broadway actor Scott Merrill died last month on June 28th. He was 82. One of Merrill's most celebrated roles was as Mac Heath, Mac the Knife, in Kurt Vile's The Threepenny Opera. From the 1954 production, here's Scott Merrill singing Ballad of the Easy Life.
They tell you that the best in life is mental. Just starve yourself and do a lot of reading. Up in some garret where the rats are breeding. Should you survive, it's purely accidental. If that's your pleasure, go on, live that way. But since I've had it up to here, I'm through. There's not a dog from here to Timbuktu would care to live that life a single day. So listen closely to a Mac the Knife. The bulging pocket makes the easy life. Now once I used to think it might be worthy to be a brave and sacrificing person. I soon found out it wasn't reimbursing. Decided to continue being earthy. The noble poor are nobly underfed. And being brave will bring an empty fame. You're all alone with no one else to blame. You're mingling with the great, but you are dead. Where's the percentage? Ask Mac the Knife. The bulging pocket makes the easy life.
Scott Merrill as Mac Heath in the Threepenny Opera. Merrill died last month. He was 82. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Megan Howell, and Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Peter Clowney.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Grant by Max Bird, a novel of the life of Ulysses S. Grant, and from Nonsuch Records, now featuring Joko, the current album by Senegalese world music artist Youssou N'Dour, available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The off-Broadway rock musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch is now a movie. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with John Cameron Mitchell, who wrote, directed, and stars in it. Also, Spinal Tap's Christopher Guest. I'm Peter Clowney. Join us for the next Fresh Air.